Hello and welcome again to No Killing Goblins. I'm Dragonus and this is Ocean.
Hey.
And we're here again to talk about the same thing we're here to talk about every week. More Wandering Inn. And this is some juicy stuff upcoming.
And other stuff. We started talking about other stuff now, right?
Although I do just love to talk, so hearing my own voice talk about all the things I like to talk about is nice. It's its own reward.
It's a reward. Sure. Okay. Okay. I should stop being. I did. Like, we have books to talk about this week, and we have our lives to talk about. Speaking of which, I have a working fridge, and the level of anxiety in my life has gone down by a significant amount. How in the world does a refrigerator control this much of my fucking life? Modern technology is both a blessing and a curse.
Yeah, I mean, fridges are scarily fundamental.
No way to store food properly, no way to make sure, like, half the food that we buy is designed around, like, being kept in a refrigerator so that we can eat it later. I can't, this, it was too much.
I've had to live without them before. It is a pain because it really limits what you can buy, but...
On this topic, it made me think about all of the ways the Wandering Inn avoids talking about the preservation of food by saying that a skill did it. Oh God, let me tell you. I was watching old episodes of TNG with a couple of my friends because we're introducing one of them to TNG because he's like 12. No, he's not 12, but he's like in his early 20s, so he's in of the generation that doesn't even know what TNG is. So he agreed to watch episodes with us, and myself and another one of my best friends is, like, we're watching this stuff, and we're the two old people commenting on the show and making it fun, because it's horrible. And then, like, she would mention all the time that one of the ways to, like, explain the logical inconsistencies, she brought up the whole, a wizard did it explanation. Have you ever heard of it? Yeah, so... I just have to say that I do not accept that as a valid explanation. I do not. I understand it can, but I do not accept that as a valid explanation, and I know the Wandering Inn can do better than a wizard did it.
Okay, so here's the thing. The context of a wizard did it is that joke in Simpsons where the pedantic nerd is pointing out a bunch of inconsistencies, right? And it's just a matter of, yes, all of this weird stuff fits because a wizard did it. And if you ever notice it, a wizard did it. And they just don't want to explain it. That's not what the Wandering Inn is doing. What the Wandering Inn does with its food preservation skills is help create a consistent and layered feel for the setting, what skills can do, how they can help Aaron, how they can help other people, what their limits are, which are a lot. Like, there is a fairly involved consistency to the way all that stuff works, so I don't feel it's appropriate to say a wizard did it. I will say, though, a lot of food preparation and food preservation, like salting stuff, fermenting, there's a few different things you can do. All of those also act as ways to prepare and make food.
All I'm gonna say is, thank you, sir, for your logic and attempt to calm me down. You ruined you're the kind of friend who comes in and brings truth and reality to my fun.
Well, the thing is, I don't think that you're entirely wrong. I do think it's a weakness to have a story that's based so much around running an inn and cooking, and not at least explore some of the fun of, say, making a century egg, or trying to ferment a bunch of stuff, or... like, the difference in texture and, like, what it does to meat to salt it long-term.
Look, hold on. If you want me to get logical about it, the biggest reason, my long-winded end of point was that convenience and a lot of the basics of what determines how we form our life and how we do things is based around the techniques and availability of the food we eat and how it's prepared, right? So I never really thought about it in that context, and it's really telling when a writer takes the details from that point of view, and it makes me think about a lot of really like intelligent writers who are able to create these really fascinating worlds, and I wonder how much of it is based on their ability to think about the world from, well, how do they eat, sleep, and poop? And they answer those basic questions and come up with these brilliant worlds because those basic questions define us, or at least living beings as we understand them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, that was my point. Moving on, what's the new book of the week? I'm excited. I can't wait to see what you got for me.
Oh, so the book that I've wanted to talk about, and I realize now that, God, I might be starting a trend because it is another book that has a harsh, unforgiving, violent society that lives in a desert. And I'm just going to go ahead and throw this trigger warning out there. And you know, I can't use that one because that one would be spoilers. But
The book has some trigger stuff to it. Let's leave it
well,
at
so
that.
the, yeah, let me describe the basic premise. A young girl who is in such a virulently abusive situation with her father, she doesn't even have a name, who lives in the ass end of nowhere in a desert, winds up being sold into slavery, and frankly, at that point, the slavery is an upgrade in her life. That kind of tells you everything you need to know here about just how awful this girl's life is at the beginning. Eventually, she gets the name Hecate, and the best way I could think of to describe this is my favorite villain origin story for a series I've ever read. The
Dragoness,
whole.
you're going into the plot scenario. You haven't even told me who the writer is or what the book's name is.
Oh, yeah. It's called Empress by Karen Miller, which I realize the trend here is this is another author out of Australia writing a story about a bunch of people living in a desert.
Well, yeah. Okay.
Karen Miller's a bit better known, though.
Okay.
I think like her Innocent Mage, which was a Kingmaker, Kingbreaker, I remember got
I've
like
read
a
that.
big push over here. Oh, you have? Because that's another book I wanted to talk about at some
I've read
point. I
the
love those books. I love their sequels.
I've read the Innocent Mage. I've never read the Empress book that you're talking about.
Yeah, but she also wrote some Star Wars stuff and some Stargate stuff. So she's probably better known, and hopefully some people around here have heard of her. But going back to the plot scenario thing, it's very much a villain origin story, and the only way I could think of to put it is life has been really harsh to this girl, and she has learned the lesson that you just need to up the ante and be harsher back. And it's called Empress for a reason, and there's a lot of lines crossed. It's a fascinating story. It really gets you into your head, and you really want to root for her. And then you sort of get closer to the end and realize that the next two books are, at the risk of some very minor spoilers, just to help set up the scenario of this trilogy, people living in other countries that have to deal with her.
I are we talking about a Walter White? We're not talking about a Walter White scenario. We're talking
No.
about.
Walter White never in his life had an excuse half as good as this girl did
Well,
to write that.
that's the thing. It's not about an excuse. You're talking about a person who is infinitely brutal because that is her existence, a brutal one. And is that evil if it's not really a choice that she had? Like a choice in making, if that makes sense. Like there was no point where she, I'm extrapolating, there was no point where she had an alternative. This is her existence, this is what she learned. So it's like introducing us to somebody who's never had sugar in their life and they don't know what sugar is and they don't know how to work with it, how to live with it, how to eat it. How can you judge someone who exists in brutality for not being kind when brutality is kindness to them? Like, if you're slightly less brutal, you're suddenly incredibly kind and merciful, right? Instead of
Yeah.
like snapping off their fingers and cutting their eyes out, you only snap off half their fingers and don't cut out their eyes. but blind them some other way that's less demeaning? I don't know.
No, I get what you mean. And, I can't say, like, that there's never an opportunity for her to, like, receive some kindness and show some. But, God, by the time that that kind of thing is coming up in her life, she is just not, like, the kind of person anymore. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of ways, she is the exemplar of this brutal, violent society that worships what I can only describe as a evil scorpion god.
It's right? Why, like, is it always a scorpion god? Oh god.
I think people kind of mentally associate scorpions with deserts, right? And they are very alien looking arachnid creatures. They carry a lot of that same fear you get when you see a spider, but they've also got giant claws, violent tails. Like, you see them and they evoke that almost like shiver runs up your spine, your eye is twitching, oh god, get it off me response. It's kind of like snakes.
Yeah, that, it does sound fascinating, and it does sound like something that would be fun to read. I don't know if I will, because I'm gonna tell you right now, I am full up on dystopian everything. I have lived a decade where I've had to experience the deluge of YA and dystopian fiction. I know the world is being destroyed. I no longer give a shit.
I could see that. And honestly, like, I feel like if a person really wanted to, they could just read the second two books. Starting at, God, what was the name of it? Fractured something? The Riven Kingdom. Right, it's a like perfectly fine place to start. I think you would lose a bit from not understanding sort of the villains and the society that they're coming from and what's going on better. But like, honestly, that book and its premise is so good and interesting to me that I could almost pitch it as its own as a starting place.
Okay. Well,
it'd be.
Sorry. Go ahead. Keep going.
Oh, because it's, you know, sort of also a bit of more of a classic archetype. King is dead, no male heirs, princess needs to try and stop a civil war and establish herself as the queen. Oh, and in the middle of all of this, you have the main character from the first book and her country she's now the empress of, sort of overrunning everyone and anyone nearby them with, like, very brutal efficiency. Very fun, very good. Also worth checking out if maybe you don't want to stomach some of the stuff in this second book, first book, as a good starting point.
Okay. I was, I guess I have new stuff to talk about, new books. Almost everything that I've been looking forward to for a few years came out in the same time because, yay, supply chain problems. Tired writers exhausted by the pandemic, and they all scheduled around the last week or two of August. And I had a book come out by Shannon McGuire, Jim Hines, Alona Andrews. I can't remember names. They will come to me. Patricia Briggs. The new... Okay, this is one you like. There's a new book out called Babel. It's essentially academic dark fiction. I didn't want to read it because I need happiness right now, but it's actually really neat and you should check it out.
I'm sorry, you'll have to... Academic dark fiction.
Yeah, so I honestly don't know how to describe it. So R.F. Kuang, I think that's how you pronounce his last name, wrote a book called Babel and Arcane History. And the book is about going to Oxford. That's the only way I have to describe it. It's an orphan. The main character is named Robin Swift. And he's brought to London by a Professor Lovell. Actually, I don't want to get too much into it, but essentially it's about someone who is brought to the center of British Empire kind of deal. A Chinese boy is brought to Britain and he comes to be in the tower called Babel in Oxford, the city of dreaming spires. And it's like, it's sort of tonally like Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, but it's more about colonial resistance and student revolutions and the use of translation as a tool of empire. How you can take the reality of what it is and then sort of soften the edges through translation, to quote unquote translation. I don't want to talk too much deeply about it because honestly, I'm only like a third of the way through. I haven't actually read all the way through it, but it's interesting. I honestly, it's a very, you know, a lot of the themes are things that are rough to read, so it's hard, but I think it's worth it. I enjoyed it. I think it's something that you would enjoy, Dragonus.
Yeah, I will. I wound up blowing my Audible credit this month on The Martian, actually, which I'd read before, but I'm working on a sci-fi giant robot RPG setting, and I needed to, like, get myself in the mindset of stuff on Mars. But I will pick it up with my next one, probably.
And
you know what the real...
Hold on. The full title is Babel, or The Necessity of Violence, : An Arcane History of the Oxford Translators' Revolution.
That's a title.
Yeah.
We'll definitely have to make sure we put that one down, because no one will remember it. And I think there's also, like, a translating program called Babel, so, yeah, you know, it's even harder to find. But... if there's a real trend here from what you said, it's both of us seem to really enjoy recommending very harsh books.
No, because I have so many happy books to recommend. It's just that I always assume that if you're going to talk about that dark stuff, I can't just be beaten by you. I have to get darker. No.
Well, I mean, not everything I want to talk about. Okay, actually, yeah, not everything I want to talk about is dark or harsh or, like, being set in settings where bad things happen to people. It's just the stuff that like that I would want to talk about is already really popular. And I figure if I have any number of people listening to me, I can, you know, point out some old classics from, like, authors who I think could deserve some more love. And there just happens to be overlap with those being very harsh settings in books.
I think the only, like, older book that I want people to read is, which I was going to talk about, that's fun. Tanya Huff is a writer from, that was in her heyday in the, like, late 90s, early aughts. And she's still great. She's still writing. But one of her series is called Take the Keeper. I think that's it. Or the Keeper series. Let me just double check. You fill some time while I check. I don't want to.
Yeah, no problem. well, actually, I was going to say is I did wind up reading, well, kind of, one of your book recommendations.
Which one?
Last week. None of the actual books you recommended. but I looked up Sean and Maguire, and I saw in the name of, like, you know, the bibliography, the name of a book that stood out to me was, like, absolute violence, and I knew I had to track it down, buy a copy, and read it. It was called Dying with Her Cheer Pants On.
Oh my god, I love... Okay, so the series that he's talking about is called the Crypto... Nah. Fuck, I can't remember the name. Ugh, I hate myself now.
It's like The Fighting Pumpkins, right? Because it is a series of short stories that were collected for that book with some stuff written in.
Yes.
About a group of cheerleaders who have a... You know, it's already, you know, a sport with what you would call a disproportionately high injury rate. A lot of people don't realize that about cheerleading. But, like, yeah, people get hurt getting thrown around and doing tumbling midair 20 feet up, or however high it is they launch people. This, though, is even worse because it's kind of like the Buffy scenario. Something is just wrong in the town, and for some reason involving mystical bullshit, it is the cheer team's job to deal with it. The story picks up because the cheer team has all entirely and mysteriously disappeared overnight, and now a new one needs to be formed. It will be formed. It's going to be. It is already decided. You're just along for the
ride. It's like if you mixed Buffy with Cthulhu levels of mystical shit, and it's essentially this weird... So do you know the magical girl trope, the thing from anime and manga from East Asia, the magical girls?
Yeah.
And you know of Madoka Magica?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's sort of like that where it turns...
Why no Madoka magic?
Look, I'm trying to let the listeners in on this. So for those who don't know, there is a sort of deep divide in the development of magical girls. So in my youth, there was things like Cardcaptor Sakura and Sailor Moon, which is all very positive, sort of shoujo romance, everything goes well, nice and everything. And then came Madoka Magica, which kind of turned the entire genre on its head and introduced something very similar to what shonen is doing.
Not to be that guy, because if we start talking about this subject, we will never leave it, but that is a highly oversimplistic interpretation.
I know that. I know that.
The genre has always been had a great deal of darkness lurking at the edges. It's just a lot of it got scrubbed out of Sailor Moon and Cardcaptor Sakura when they came over.
Know that. It's just a very careful, like, that scrubbing part is what I'm saying is gone. And then they embraced it and made it the core function of the thing. That's what I mean by the thing. And shonen does the same thing. She takes these floofy, supposedly, you know, not a huge big deal group and turns them into what would it be like if every single cheerleader was Buffy?
Yeah, I don't entirely agree with the metaphor, but I don't want to get bogged down in it. I will say, though, the characters were all fascinating. Side effect of, like, just the way that this team is formed is that people who are already maybe a little bit supernatural are pulled into it. Like, the point of view character leading the team is a half-vampire. You have a dryad, a group of girls who are all the same person in multiple bodies. It's crazy.
It is
very,
very
funny. It has a great sense of humor. And like most good stories with a great sense of humor, it gets you laughing so it can punch you right in your sternum and make you then very sad or very afraid or both.
Just don't judge the cover. Literally, one of the reviews I think was don't judge a book by its cover. Don't judge this one by its cover either. I think the hardcovers are almost impossible to find, but you can get a Kindle copy very easily or an e-copy very easily. It's fun. It's the kind of story Shonen likes to tell, where it's very comic book poppy. And
yeah,
I found the Tanya Huff stuff. So can I talk about it, or you got more to say about Dying with Tokyo?
Just one more thing I was gonna say about that. Okay. I'm impressed at how like an almost sort of gag level series of fun short stories then turned out to have such a deep and interesting background lore, like the Pee Wee basketball team that has to save the world twice a week, or the old lady's knitting circle that also gets up.
That is, by the way, the entirety of Shonen. She takes the simplest of matters and finds the magic in them. That's why I recommended her to you. Before I forget,
I'll keep reading her stuff.
Yeah, before we move on. So the Tanya Huff series that I'm talking about is called The Keeper's Chronicles. It starts with Summon the Keeper. It's basically about Claire, whose job it is as a keeper to keep the metaphysical fabric of the universe together. And she gets to this hotel a hole in the basement to hell, and she meets Dean, a man without magical powers who works as a handyman, and it's just so fucking funny. You have to read it, and I will not spoil any more of it, because we don't have time, because I think we're over our 25-minute limit. We're way over the limit. Let's get started on the chapter.
Yeah, no, now is a good time, I believe, to get started on the chapter. Which, God, these are chapters with so much to talk about.
That's why I was like, rushing.
These are some meaty ones.
Yeah, that's why I was rushing, because, oh my God, these are some... So we're talking about chapters 45 and 46 of the second volume of The Wandering Inn, based on the wonderful, beautiful... Well, soon to be edited, hopefully, table of contents on the Wandering Inn website. So chapter 45 starts off with Aaron at Octavia's, and then everything's chill, everything's cool, except turns out somebody's running. Ryoka's running, and she thinks she's trying to avoid it being too late, because something terrible is going to happen.
Ryoka, as always, convinced that she is in fact the only person in the world with agency, and that if she doesn't sprint all the way from Liscor to Terriark, Eren will die. Which, admittedly, it's Eren. It's not an entirely, like, out of left field fear.
Yeah, to be honest, that is true. But Ryoka's, this entire section, I love the way Pirate turned it on its head. Normally, what would happen is we just dive into Ryoka being a panicky, wanicky, running to the through the snow and rock and barefoot, trying to get to Terriark to save the day, and you would like, and she would save the day. But no, Pirate just breaks all of that tension, reveals that Eren is just fine, and brings us into Ryoka panicked about Eren. And saying things like, she's the best thing in the world! I have to save her!
I will say, actually, this is, for me, a really important moment for liking and understanding Ryoka better. When you realize that Ryoka, despite the fact that she is not good at it, does like and consider Eren a friend.
And
And
go ahead.
she has lost a lot of people since she's gotten here. The Horns, the Stone Spear tribe. It is a what's the primary way to put this? It's understandable. It's almost PTSD-esque the way that like Eren goes briefly missing, and she just has this switch flip in her head. The worst is going to happen. I have to find the biggest stick I can to beat this problem with. Immediately starts running to the dragon.
And sorry, I don't start with Ant. So the part of the chapter that sort of comes across as, oh, okay, let me take this back. What's clever about this chapter is the way Pirate frames the Fae in relation to Ryoka. Both the beginning, the middle, the end, all of it. Pirate uses the Fae as an audience circuit at and literally at a time. There's a section in the chapter where they recite Shakespeare. Straight up. They recite fucking Shakespeare and they use it as a way to laugh at Ryoka and the audience laughs with them. Like, this whole section has this weird kind of tension between Ryoka's panic and the Fae's almost lackadaisical way of dealing with the world where they care. They care about everything. They're watching everything. But you know what? That means that they know that Eren's alive and that this is all just fun and they're poking it at Ryoka for their own amusement. Like,
Yeah, and like real talk, if Eren was right now currently dead or in mortal danger and they were roasting Ryoka this hard for being worried, then it would be savage. But like we know she's safe and that releases a lot of that tension.
and the Fae clearly know she's safe, but they won't tell her. They're just roasting her because it's funny, and it creates this both laughable moment where you're allowed to laugh at Ryoka, but also this moment it makes you sympathetic. It reinforces the sympathy you should feel for Ryoka's panic due to her trauma response, right? Like, it's a very
Yeah.
clever way. It's not clever, what am I saying? It's just a unique Pirate way of getting to the same kind of feeling. Other authors might try to do it by making us focus down on Ryoka and empathize with her pain. Pirate does it by having somebody else make fun of her and then us empathizing with the poor girl who's being made fun of.
Yeah, meanwhile, though there's one specific like series of lines from the fairies that they all say like right on top of each other very early that I think also gives us a big window into what like they want, what they're interested in, what they're getting out of this. It's because we are bored, because you defy the fates, because of a grain of sand, because you would challenge gods, because we can. Right?
Right,
Like
exactly. I love the way the Fae are portrayed here. It's interesting the way it's done because what immortals have to care in order to exist because they don't fear death or the ending the same way mortals do. So how do they stay engaged with the world? How do they not just like sit in place and go, okay, they're like a rock or something. And this is their mission statement. Because they can.
Yeah, and you know, the conversation back and forth, I think it sets the tone for this conversation with Teriark that when she talks to the fairies and tries to convince them to help her, she's almost like she's trying to outsmart them. Like, oh, well, there's a cost for the audience, too. You have to chip in. Like, she really is just convinced she can scheme her way past these people if they don't want to give her what she wants, which leads to her sprinting right into Teriark's house, screaming his name.
And revealing that she knows that he's a dragon, challenging him to a riddle contest, which the Fae try to like turn into this story time mode, which Teriark is having none of, which I loved. He's definitely cranky old man all the way through.
Oh yeah, and I fucking love that idea too. Like I'm now picturing like two people getting into a rap battle with the Fae around, and suddenly the entire scene shifts. The art style goes into pastels, and now they're rapping at each other in Shakespearean verse and iambic pentameter, and then suddenly very confused by it. I don't know why, but every time I read this chapter, that image kicks into my head.
I don't want to get, like, this is too spoilery. We'll talk about it later, but there's so many hints in this chapter that didn't make sense until, like, much, much later. And,
There's so much going
oh
on,
my
like in the
God,
background.
there's so much. He just, paying attention helps, and I regret not paying attention because so much shit that got revealed later just, Fire is like, put it all out there and then watch the babies not know what's going on and just, like, steeple their fingers like a super villain going, ah, they don't
It's like
know.
Gendo Akari, fingers in the position, glasses flashing in the shadows. Excellent.
Excellent. Yeah, exactly. But even without knowing some of the things that we know, it's still a really exciting and interesting chapter. There's so much like stuff going on. And yet, when we think about the events of it, it's fairly simple. Ryoko runs to the high passes again, breaks into Teriark's cave again, challenges Teriark to a riddle contest, which he promptly beats her at because he's a dragon, she's a kid, and then she gives up and has an existential crisis, and Teriark is like, okay, you know what? All right, little baby girl, fine. Here's what you wanted. And it's just like, and in all the meantime, Teriark is treating the Fae as pests, and the Fae are like, we're gonna fuck with you, and it's just, it's fun and emotional. And at the end of the chapter, I think what makes it the best part for me is that Ryoko might not have won the riddle contest, but she won Teriark's attention and what's the word I'm looking for? Not caring. What, like, he cares about her?
Yeah, he is invested, even if he maybe doesn't want to be. I will say, I think one of my favorite parts is once you start to get to the end of this rap battle, and Ryoka is both kind of having it easy because all the riddles that he asks are like old classics in our world. And she starts throwing out like programming and logic puzzles and like, that one where it's like the blue colored forehead thing, and the fairies just go, "What the fuck are you
That's
doing?"
not how it's supposed to go, bitch! Turn around and do it the right way. Like, I just love them so
Yeah.
much. Like, somehow they're the most ordinary crowd ever. They want new experiences, but they want new experiences the way they want the experiences to be. And it's very much like audience troll from YouTube comments kind of deal.
Yeah, it's like that's not a riddle, that's just math. Like it was funny to me just the way that like that appears to be like just the fucking breaking point for these fairies, and then Teriark just chases them out, which it's interesting he can do that.
And he, honestly, at the end, he just turns into like grandpa and like literally tells her, wipe your nose. And goes, here's
Oh
your
God.
spell. I just,
And then she.
yeah. And then
Oh,
she
sorry.
what? And then she what?
And then she mentions like Enigma to him, and like now she's teaching the dragon the Enigma code, and it's either going to be quaint to him or it's going to be fascinating to him. But either way, it's going to be an interesting conversation.
And Ryoka Griffin has caught the attention of Terioch the dragon. And it's just like, I don't know if that's a good or bad thing, but you did it. And that is the entirety of chapter 45. It's so such a fast read, so dense in like information that will come of like importance later, but at the same time being like an action chapter, right?
And also just dense and interesting conversation. I could talk for almost 5 minutes about every individual line of dialogue
We
almost between
will
her and
not be
Terioch.
doing
I
that.
know we won't be doing that, but like this is a chapter where I feel like I really could do that. Like they're both very interesting characters at this point, and I mean he's a fucking dragon. He's a dragon. Who doesn't want to hear and like read and talk more about the dragon?
The author note is interesting because Pirate thought it could use some polish and that they ran out of time. And I'm like, okay, what the fuck would a palace chapter look like? Everybody, and as usual, everybody in the comments going like, okay, you could take a break, and Pirate's doing their, oh, I don't want to take a break, people will leave me, which took nearly 3 years of insistence from us for them to finally take a real break.
I don't know if maybe Pirate went back and looked at this chapter later, but like if this chapter is already like polished to a fine shine, the only place where I see there could ever really have been roughness would be in the transition to and from the drama mode from the Fae is the best way I can think of to put it. When they end like some of the stuff with the riddles, but it all like flows and fits and works. I don't see it. This one was really good. This is one of the highlight chapters of the whole book.
I think Pirates mentioned before more than a few times that they find like writing intelligent characters to be difficult because you have to think in 5D science for multiple characters because you're not just thinking about how one character will respond, but also the intelligent ones on the other side of it. And it can get really complicated and like you have to space it out and trying to make it all fit into a story can be hard.
Yeah, no, I think there's an author called Peter Watts who's talked about something similar where a couple books involve what could be described as conflicts between beings that are so much smarter than humanity by default that it is very difficult to portray the fact that they are literally just better. So they're plotting against each other, and you have this human character stuck in the middle. And how do you try and deliver how truly outside of his depth and unable to change things this guy is, right?
And if that's the case, how does the human get to influence the world around him? Because,
He, I mean, I might talk about this book at some point, but he
let's
doesn't.
leave it at that and go on to the next chapter, which is 2.46.
Yep. Just for people to note, we are skipping Wistrom Days. In book three, we shall be doing all of them in one discrete chunk.
Volume 3.
That one,
Yeah.
yeah.
So what it, you start off, you started talking about it.
So book, sorry, chapter 246 opens up with just a complete reversal from Ryoka panicking. It's Ryoka laughing. As she realizes that she has just sprinted across, like, I don't even know how long it is from Liscor up to where Terioch lives, nonstop, got roasted by the Fae, made fun of, pissed them all off, picked a riddle fight with a dragon, and Eren is currently just hanging out in Selim, probably getting talked at by Octavia about pricing for the bees. Who knows?
And they're having a fun time making experiments and doing crazy stuff, and Terioch is like, oh, look, she's fine.
Yeah, no, Terioch has real introvert energy. He wanted nothing to do with any of this, but now that you're here, let's talk for 5 hours.
Yeah, and at the end, like, Terioch is very much This is the stupidest comparison to make because it's not, the comparison is not real. But Tarek reminds me of myself when I was in like 22, 23, and I just wanted the world to leave me alone. I wanted to stay in my room, be on the internet, occasionally read things, keep my stuff, and sleep all the time. And that's the utter definition of depression. The perfect definition of depression. The inability to deal with anything outside of yourself. And just when you get the chance, you're excited, you're ready to deal with it, but the minute your energy runs out, you're done and you want it to go away. And you just want to sleep over and over again. And that just, I mean, that was Terry Arc. At least that's how I saw him when I first read it.
Yeah, same. And I almost sort of love, I'm trying to find the right way to put like this chapter and its events into words, because it really is Ryoka and the dragon chill and hang out. And there's some back and forth about, oh, well, we can do this in my world, which, he seems remarkably unsurprised that she's from another world.
And that she can be here. He just assumes that someone figured out a way for her, like her, to travel. And she, I don't even understand why he's not curious. He's a dragon. How did two people from another world end up on, like, not even a bit of curiosity? He's just like, oh, okay, it happened. And in the meantime, everything that she talks about and all the things that she presents as part of her world is like, oh yeah, people did that before on our world too. They're dead now, but they did do it. And
Yeah, and sort of the back and forth, and then the stuff with the phone, especially. If anything, I don't think she talked up the phone enough.
I don't think he understood what the phone was capable of. He saw it as a toy and an item that he could possess because he's a dragon. But the implications didn't quite cro come across to him, and I don't know why. I think I've always been confused about why that was. He had access to it. Maybe he just didn't see it as anything like m remarkable because magic could reproduce everything that it could do.
Yeah, that it could be, and I really also like the stuff with the gnolls, right? Because I feel like Ryoka comes in, she swaggers up, she tries to do the riddle contest, make the demands, and then eventually she realizes that the real secret to this is the fucking dragon. Just butter him up. Talk about how cool he is. Talk about how magnificent and grand he is. Talk about how magnanimous and kind he is. Wouldn't he love to deliver a just something to these gnolls so that they can remember him? And it's a God, what's the word? Not an endowment. No, like when you buy a new library at a college and they
That's an
name it after you.
endowment.
That is an endowment. Okay, yeah. Okay, it turns out I'm smarter than I thought I was. It's like, yeah, look at this endowment, right? You can give this gift to the gnolls, and the gnolls will, like, remember you forever, and they'll name it after you, and it's an act of charity, and you have so much.
And for Ryoka, it's a good reminder that she actually did learn a little bit from her running all the way to the high passes and doing all this stuff and trying to trick people. You can just ask for help and bargain and trade, and even a dragon will willingly bargain and trade with you because dragons aren't in, like, if he wanted you dead, he'd be dead. So stop being so afraid and treat them like a person. And I wish she had done that with Magnolia, but that's neither here nor there. What?
So the same thing that I think helps her in this situation is she's mentioned repeatedly that her father is a politician of some sort, right?
Or an
And that she
ambassador.
had, again, that an ambassador is by definition a politician. Like somebody who, if anything, it's somebody who is even more focused on the diplomatic end of things. So we have this setup where Ryoka has, terrible fucking daddy issues and hates her father and hates everything to do with him and really can't stand Magnolia for similar, she radiates that elite moneyed aspect. But she probably also learned a lot about how to be diplomatic when she's willing to be diplomatic. Like, it's got to be a skill set that was invested into her at some point.
And she apparently remembers it enough to trade her iPhone for the solution to Kershaya's problems. a book that teaches you magic, which is like the Rihal Imperium's book, by the way, is what I wouldn't give to have something like that, that teaches you without having to like memorize things, but actually teaches you, like shows you, helps you understand why, and isn't so interested in like permanent, like repetitive memorization. Ugh, I can't say things.
Yeah. Also, one minor flex that actually was on Terriark is the copying of the iPhone, where he's like, "Oh, what? Nah, this is easy. Just plucks a piece off of it, repairs it." And you know that moment where Lisa's like, "Yeah, I got this, I got this." You hand them a box, and then they kind of have that moment where like it's heavier than they expected, and they kind of go, "Oof." That's how I picture that moment when he does reconstruct and goes, "Well, my, that was more than I expected." Well, I mean, as you can see, it's easy. It's not as valuable as you think it is.
Like, it's, I don't know. All of this was very like what defines this chapter, what defines Ryoko's interaction with him, is that Terriar cares about how people see him, even if it's just how he sees himself. And the definition of what allows Ryoko to interact with Terriar is because Terriar has such, maybe it's his ego. We can dismiss it as his ego, but Terriar's a dragon. A dragon has more than just an ego. He also has a healthy image of himself. And when Ryoko pricked that sense of who he is, a noble creature who does no wrong, or at least a dragon that isn't a thief. He claims what he has, and he has gained all, and his collection is unsullied by thievery and like petty things like mortals would do. And here Ryoka is accusing him of doing something like thievery, like so petty, and he's off.
Here's my thought though.
Yeah.
Did gnomes have smartphones? Because he says, when she says that 32 gigabytes is over 100,000 books, and he says so many, but the gnomes could only get like what could the gnomes only get so many of onto? I want to know.
The question is,
Like
did they? Because the thing for me is, if gnomes had access to magic and you had other ways to create condensed ways to transmit information, you wouldn't focus too much on the complexity of creating microchips and stuff because you don't need it. So it would make sense that the gnomes, if they were a technological race but had access to magic, wouldn't be so focused on this. I didn't really think about it too much.
I don't know. He mentions they made it to the moon, and then it's just Terriark is simultaneously surprised and not surprised by so many things here, right? And he's a dragon. He's presumably been around a while. So I find myself everything he says, like I analyzed it and I went over it, and like I read this chapter 3 times my first read through, wanting to like figure out why is he not surprised she's from another world? Why is he not surprised that people could make it to the moon? Why is he surprised at the smartphone, but not surprised at the concept of the smartphone. Like, there's so much going on with Terriark and what he does and what he doesn't say. And Pirate being Pirate, I sort of give Pirate the credit that probably everything in here was meant to be thought
Well,
about.
then again, that's the thing though. We know that a lot of it does get explained in the future, right? This is a minor spoiler. Yes, there are answers if you keep reading. Sorry.
True, but they're also yeah, I know. I was trying to think about this from like where I was the first time I read through this.
Now, when the answers come, you should read and find out. But I was gonna say, I made a joke and you didn't even like. I just gave you a whole dissertation on what on trying to think about it, and then I said, sometimes Dragonus doesn't hear my jokes and other people don't hear my jokes, and I'm like, I'm sitting here and going, I guess dry humor is not funny. I'll never be a stand-up.
I mean, I'll admit I completely missed that you had made a joke. Yeah, I was too busy thinking about just,
I get it. You're
God, this is such a
thinking.
fun chapter.
I get it. You're thinking about the chapter, not your friend. I understand. I'm not that important. Anyway, time to end the episode.
Well, hold on, before we end the episode, there is still some stuff at the end of this chapter. Terriarch sends Ryoka away, saying they won't meet again, which bullshit.
No, he said it. Obviously, it's true. It's always gonna be true, right? I mean,
I mean,
he said it last time, and it was completely true this time, right?
yep. Ryoka arrives right in time for Octavia and Aaron to apparently be in a screaming fit. Sorry, Octavia and Aaron in a screaming fit because, Aaron just has that effect on people.
Well, if they're not screaming, they're at least running away from her. And then Pirate is. I forgot something. One of the things I remember Pirate saying casually when they were writing, volume. I forget which volume, but they were just talking in Discord and stuff. That dragons change everything, and that they are really reluctant to write about or include something like Terriarch in the story because it changes everything, and they don't know how to keep the story from warping around such a big character, which is why you see Terriarch, but always in these blips, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's why they do it. Anyway, I'm good. Are you good?
Yeah, I'm good.
All right, everybody, thanks for listening. And we're all done for this week. Join us again for the final episode of No Calling Goblins for Volume 2 next week. And then after that, we're going to have a short break where we reread Volume 3 and restructure our show to present Volume 3 in a whole different way. Look out for that. We'll give you a nice idea of what we have planned in the next episode.
All right. Well, congratulations, everybody. We are almost to the end of Volume 2. I missed it. Wow. I not even t considered how close we were. All right. Well, good night, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
You've been listening to No Killing Goblins. The music on No Killing Goblins was composed by System Glitch. They can be found at youtube.com/systemglitch. You can get in touch with us via our Twitter at NoKillingGoblin or email us at NoKillingGoblins with an S at gmail.com.